What's good and welcome to the Hockey Mailbag, the first sports podcast run entirely by the listeners. I'm your host, Brandon Rewicki, and each episode here follows a simple format. You send me whatever hockey-related questions are on your mind, I provide the answers. If you want to be a part of the podcast, just send your questions to thehockeymailbag@gmail.com or to me on Twitter at Brandon_Rewicki. And to kick off the podcast ahead of the new season, we're going to start with a four-part series breaking down each of the four divisions in the NHL, making sure we give a little love to each team along the way. Today's episode focuses on the Central Division, which had the busiest team from this past offseason, and that's where we've got to kick things off today. And the first question of the episode goes out to Andy, who writes, what is Barry Trotz cooking in Nashville? I'll tell you what, Andy, Trotz is cooking with gasoline right now. It's a Michelin meal out in Tennessee. Barry Trotz is going to be on season four of The Bear at this point. I mean, that was, as far as July 1 goes, that's got to be a Mount Rushmore July 1 moment. Just seeing Barry Trotz sign guy after guy after guy. I mean, completely remodeling the Predators franchise in just a matter of minutes, maybe even an hour. It was like Barry Trotz found Teemu for the first time. Just adding stuff to his card before you know it. High-end second pair defensemen. Two veteran second liners. We got ourselves a stew going here. So I think Barry Trotz had himself one hell of an offseason. I also don't think it was spending just for the sake of spending. Like, I wonder if Seattle maybe went a little bit down that route. I don't mind the Montour signing the Kraken made. The Stevenson one looks to be a bit of a nightmare, right? But you kind of get what I'm saying, like the distinction between the two. It felt like Seattle spent to spend, whereas the Predators were a little more mindful, even though they gave up like $100 million worth of contracts. But I think Stammer's still got a lot of juice left in the tank. I mean, Marchessault has proven that you get to the dance, he's one of the best big game performers in the NHL. And Brady Shea, is $7 million a bit too much? Maybe, but the cap's going up. And at the very least, you don't need him to be the guy since Roman Josi is ahead of him there, right? I mean, Yossi's 34 too. Philip Forsberg isn't getting any younger. I don't mind Barry Trotz almost making a bet on his team and the group he's put together and saying, you know what? This opportunity doesn't come around too often. Let's make a move here. Let's be aggressive. I can respect that. And I think he's got himself a hell of a coach in Andrew Brunette. I think that's a huge part of why the Predators surprised a lot of people for the majority of this past season. And I think giving him some more offensive talent, I mean, you saw what he did in his full season with, his half season with Florida, season with New Jersey, and he disappears and the Devils almost fall apart, right? But I think Andrew Brunette is going to get the most out of all of the players he's got at his disposal. So I'd like the... It was mindful, reckless spending by Barry Trotz. But then on top of all that, you throw in the Yaroslav Askarov trade at the end. That to me is the cherry on top because, look, you commit to UC Saros long term. You lock in Vezina caliber goaltending for the next handful of years. Askarov becomes a moot point for you. And you're still able to parlay that into a first round pick and a former first-round pick prospect on top of that. And now you've got yourselves three firsts in this upcoming draft if you're Barry Trotz, which gives you a ton more ammo to make a move during the regular season or going ahead to the trade deadline there. So he's got a ton of options still, a ton of assets. He can maneuver either way, a lot of flexibility. Barry Trotz had himself an all-timer of an offseason there, and I think Preds fans have every right to be extremely jacked about this upcoming season. I will say this final note about the Predators. I don't know how realistic the trade smoke has been around this specific player, but Trevor Zegras would make a ton of sense and he would fit in great having Ryan O'Reilly as his shotgun partner there. O'Reilly takes the tough matchups. You allow Zegras to be who he is. all the pressure isn't thrown on him, I think that would be a great fit. I don't know if he's still up for grabs or if he ever was, but if he is, would not be surprised to see Barry Trotz go all in on a guy like Trevor Zegras. So not quite calling my shot on that just yet, but if the trade happens, I will 1,000% claim that I called that before the season got underway. But thanks for the question there, Andy. Exciting times out there in Nashville. Next up, we go to JT4. And that JT4 asks, how aggressive should Chicago be at improving their roster, or should the Hawks chase another high draft pick this upcoming season? Interesting question there, JT4. I actually think it is of utmost importance, and I think Chicago feels this way too, that the number one goal right now is to immediately improve the roster. And I could make the case that Chicago maybe wasn't aggressive enough this past offseason at supplementing Bedard and the rest of the young core there in Chicago with more NHLers right off the bat. Because what you absolutely cannot do, look, there's numerous ways to rebuild a team. There's numerous ways to fail a rebuild. But I think what a lot of failed rebuilds seem to have in common is that if you go scorched earth, you better build that thing up quickly, because if you don't, losing becomes a habit. And once losing becomes a habit, it's like cat pee in a house. It's going to take paint and new floors and whatever else to get that out, right? So I think it is absolute utmost importance for Chicago to avoid any of that setting in. And I like what they did this offseason, right? Like, I mean, the jury's out on how effective Tyler Bertuzzi is going to be as a top line winger. But I'll tell you what, it was a hell of a lot better than what Connor Bedard was working with last year. Same goes for Teuvo Teravainen. At least they kept that one to only 3 years. But you've got Taylor Hall coming back. They were able to add Laurent Brossoit, who was the best backup in the NHL this past season. Would love to see him stay healthy and start 40, 50 games this year, but he's already going to miss a couple of weeks with a knee injury. But you've added Alec Martinez as well, TJ Brody. They desperately needed an injection of legitimate NHL talent. And the reason why I think they needed to do it too is because even with those guys in the mix, Chicago is still going to be one of the three or four worst teams in the NHL this year. Even if Bedard ends up with, let's say, a 40-40 season, there's just nowhere near enough high-end talent on that roster to do anything other than finish in the bottom five, right? So you could, if you wanted to sign nobody and finish dead last, sure, you could have done that. But why not give your franchise potentially generational superstar some legitimate help there to guide him in his sophomore season and give your team a little bit of an extra oomph, and maybe you end up with a top pick anyways? So I think this is the proper step that Chicago made here. And I think the Hawks need to be very, very mindful of the fact that going into this upcoming offseason, I think the goal should be to make the playoffs. That doesn't mean, you know, obviously strip the team of your prospects and your first round picks, but maybe you do trade one of your first or second rounders to get NHL level talent there. I'm a big believer in, once you get those guys locked up, and I think San Jose is in a similar mold too. Like, we've got our number one center, we've got our number one defenseman, a few other pieces mixed in there. All right, it's go time now. We gotta get this thing back on track, or else you end up like the Edmontons of 10 years ago, or what the Buffalo Sabres and the Ottawa Senators are going through. You cannot have losing become part of your team's DNA. So we'll see if Chicago did enough to get themselves out of the NHL basement. But thanks for the question there, JT4. Moving on to the rest of the Central, Milzy has this one for us here. Hey, I like your style, Milzy. Milzy asks, how awesome was the St. Louis double offer sheet to Edmonton? I'll tell you what, Milzy, was pretty freaking awesome. I would argue that a signed offer sheet, not only is it on the Mount Rushmore of NHL offseason moves, I think it's the Teddy Roosevelt of offseason moves. Every NHL fan gets hilariously jacked up anytime an offer sheet gets signed and delivered. And then you throw the double offer sheet out there and it's like catnip to hockey fans in the middle of August. So I look, there needs to be more of these. Everybody is in agreement on that. I just don't think it's feasible to see these things happening every single offseason. I mean, think of all the things that needed to align correctly here for this to even happen in the first place, right? Like, you needed two RFAs that were not a part of the team's core group in Broberg and Dylan Holloway. You needed that team to be crunched up against the cap. You also needed to randomly reacquire your own third round pick or your own second or third round pick from the Pittsburgh Penguins to then make an offer sheet even plausible. And then on top of all of that, you have to then convince those players to basically pull the middle finger on their old team and come over and sign with your team. Like, that's a lot of things that need to go right for an offer sheet to actually go through. So I don't think this is an omen of things to come, but this is just savvy, shrewd GM work by one of the best in the biz and Doug Armstrong. And I bet you, too, with Alex Steen being groomed to become the next GM of the Blues, if that wasn't like a little, you know, Shooter McGavin, no-look putt to Happy Gilmore. Like, hey, Steiner, this is how we do it in the pros. Double offer sheet, baby. But I like the gamble by the Blues here, especially with Broberg, who I think we can all agree did not deserve that $4.5 million cap hit. Like, that's an overpay in the short term. There's from what he's done at the NHL level. There's no doubt about that. But it times up so nicely where Krug and Falk will basically be done their $6.5 million contracts. And you'll find out what you have in Philip Broberg at that point. And if the former 10th overall pick lives up to the billing, you got a top pair D-man for a second round pick. If he doesn't, I think a second round pick is a worthy gamble to find that out. So I love the way that they attack that and try to inject some much needed youth into that blue line out there in St. Louis. And the Dylan Holloway one is just a pretty easy move, right? Like, you get a good young, cost-controlled player, and you give him the opportunity to prove himself in a new environment that he really wasn't ever going to get in Edmonton. I think there's a little more to Holloway's game than he showed with the Oilers. Like, I don't think he's ever going to be a top-line guy, but could he maybe slowly evolve into a second-line contributor for St. Louis? Yeah. And again, not a whole lot in terms of gambling your assets to find that out. So, really, really strong work from Doug Armstrong there. And Edmonton just kind of got caught with their pants down. You think they would have got that one done a little bit earlier in the offseason, but double offer sheet all day, every day. The NHL should actually mandate league-wide that there's a minimum of one offer sheet per offseason. It's got to happen from somebody. That would be Gary Bettman could get a lot of people back on his side if he was able to pull that one out of his hat. But thanks for the question there. Who was that here? Thanks for the question, Millsy. Next up on the list, Big Rob. Nice. Big Rob asks, ooh, interesting. A draft-related question. Big Rob asks, is the Dallas 2017 draft the best single draft ever in NHL history? Very interesting, Big Rob. I mean, for those that don't know, the draft where with three consecutive picks, the Dallas Stars took Miro Heiskanen, Jake Oettinger, and then capped it off with Jason Robertson in the second round. Pretty good haul. But is it the best of all time? I mean, is it better than Boston getting Barzal, Connor, and Chabot in 2015? Is that too soon, Bruins fans? Funny story quickly. I was at a draft party back in 2015 with my buddy Diddy, who's a diehard Bruins fan. And when that all lined up, I had the same response that we all did there, right? Like the famous tweet, Boston's going to get Barzal, Connor, and Chabot here. And he was jacked. And he didn't know too much about the prospects And as the names start to get picked off, and it's Sinishin, and it's Saboral, and it's DeBrusque, he just kind of turns to me. He's like, Brandon, are these guys any good? Not really, Diddy. He goes, okay. He just walks out, leaves the party, never to be seen again. So, tough one, Bruins fans, but hey, you get Marchand late in the draft. I think things have worked out for you since then. Pasternak late in the first round. I'm not going to feel too bad about the Bruins not nailing that draft, but holy crap, could you imagine that Boston team if they actually pulled that off? Nonetheless, where does Dallas's work match up with the best in the NHL? Well, I think there's two different things we have to get to here. I mean, we saw a lot more historic draft classes before the year 2000. And I think a big part of that is scouting is just way, way more advanced than it was back in the day. Like, I don't think Dallas's compares. Like, there's the 89 Red Wings class where they took Nick Lidstrom in the third, Sergei Fedorov in the fourth. I think Konstantinov was like a 12th or a 13th round pick, right? Like, you get three Hall of Fame players. Like, that's going to be tough to beat. Edmonton did the same thing with Messier and Anderson and one other guy there. So I almost don't even want to count those because it's tough to make those as clear examples. I think the next closest in the last 20 or so years, though, was probably Montreal's haul of Max Pacioretty, PK Subban, and Ryan McDonagh. I think I'm taking Dallas's over Montreal's three picks that year. And it's pretty cool, too, that you build all three levels of your team in that draft with Heiskanen on defense, obviously Ottinger in the back end, and then Robertson up front. It's going to take a long, long time for a team to match what Dallas did there. What's crazy, though, and I apologize again, hey, I mentioned this in one of the other episodes. Unfortunately, I'm a diehard Flyers fan, but here's some nightmare fuel for you in terms of what an alternate universe might look like for the Dallas Stars. But imagine if the Flyers and Stars swapped draft classes that year, and if maybe Philly took Heiskanen at number two, like their scouts reportedly wanted Ron Hextall to do. But the Philadelphia 2017 draft haul was Nolan Patrick, Morgan Frost, one pick after Jake Oettinger, and then Isaac Ratcliffe, five picks ahead of Jason Robertson. Imagine how different the Stars are if they had drafted Patrick, Frost, and Ratcliffe. And imagine how different things would be in Philly if they did what Dallas did. Pretty wild, hey? That the fortunes of two franchises, we didn't know it at the time, would go in vastly different directions. So it's wild how much luck always factors into it. But what really pisses me off, too, just from a jealousy perspective, is Jim Neal nails 2017, and then he follows that up shortly thereafter with a Wyatt Johnson, Logan Stankoven back-to-back. You get the best draft, one of the best draft classes of all time, and then you get two more high-end guys shortly after. What a run Jim Neal is on out there with the Stars. That's a team that I would love to see go deep. One that I don't cheer for. And by go deep, I mean win the Stanley Cup. Just because, the scouting alone deserves a chance at a ring there. But they built it so well. I mean, they're going to be in the mix, no doubt about it. But it almost feels like they deserve it after how well they drafted over the past several years. But thanks for the question, Big Rob, on that. Only a couple more to go here. Next up, we go to Westy. And Westy asks, how do Minnesota and Winnipeg, the Minnesota Wild and the Winnipeg Jets, go from first round fodder to Final Four favorite? Interesting question. Well, let me say this off the bat. If you ever bring alliteration to this podcast again, that's a lifetime ban. I don't have time for it. I'm just kidding. That's all right. But, I mean, I think that's a little harsh on Winnipeg. I mean, I guess they haven't won a second round series game since 2017-2018. But they did win that four-game sweep against the Edmonton Oilers in the bubble a few years back. But I guess I kind of get the point, right? Like, I mean, especially after the disaster that was that series against Colorado, you know, how do these teams go from being kind of also-rans in the playoff race to high-end Stanley Cup contenders? What's wild is the Minnesota Wild, and I think there's two different answers. I don't think it's each team has the same issues, and if they just do this, they're both going to be on their way. But with Minnesota first, the Minnesota Wild have gone 9 years without winning a playoff series. They've lost seven straight first round matchups. What the hell? Why is Minnesota so cursed as a sports city? My God. But I mean, I think it's pretty obvious what's wrong in terms of why the Wild haven't gotten over that hump. And it's the problem that a lot of teams in the NHL face that can't do that. They just don't have a number one centerman. That's it. That's the one thing that they're waiting on here. And especially after they drafted Zeev Bouyam in the first round this past year, like, they've got a great, on paper, future blue line, spearheaded by Brock Faber and Zeev Bouyam. Jesper Wallstedt might be the best goalie prospect in the NHL. And then you've got Kaprizov and Boldy up there, ready to go right now and in the future as well. All that's missing there is that number one guy. And I think Joel Eriksson Ek is a crazy underrated second line center. Love his game. But I mean, you look at that roster, and if Marco Rossi, for example, if Marco Rossi somehow took the leap as a number one guy this year, I might go as far to say that is a cup contender. But I don't think you can look at what they have right now and what he's done in his career and say, yes, he's going to figure it out now at 22 years old. He might, but that's a bet that I'm not willing to make. And so the question then becomes, if he doesn't do that, how do you go about getting that number one guy? I don't know. Not a great answer, but I don't know. You get lucky. That's how other teams have done it. It's still crazy to me that when Jack Eichel came on the trade, he was the last big one, I would say. Like, right? The last big number one center that was available via trade. It was still crazy to me that there wasn't an avalanche of offers hitting Buffalo's way, because those guys just don't become available. And of course, it's Vegas that gets them for pennies on the dollar, essentially, right? And I get there was the injury thing and all that, but I mean, that should have been something that Minnesota and several other teams should have just emptied the prospect farm to get that guy out there. And I think that's where the Wild find themselves right now, that they'll always be a competitive, pesky team with the talent that they have there, but they're just not going to get it done come playoff time until they figure out that number one center spot. And I don't know how they do that. Now, in Winnipeg, it's a bit of a different situation. There's both a micro and a macro issue that the Jets have to deal with. In the short term, maybe not as pressing as Minnesota, but there is a need to fill second line center and second pair defense. I think the Jets, if they want to, have a very strong case at saying, we get aggressive, we bring those guys in, and all of a sudden this team looks a little bit dangerous with one of the two best goalies on the planet and a top 10 defenseman behind them. And then high-end level talent out there on the wings as well. Maybe the best bottom six in the NHL too. So there's the micro part of it where if they wanted to be aggressive and they made some moves to supplement their talent, you could envision a scenario where they make a deep playoff run. It doesn't seem like they're going to do that, though. But I have a macro take on the Winnipeg Jets. And again, for full transparency here, grew up, raised, currently living in Winnipeg. So I've been a part of this city my whole life. I've seen the Jets 1.0 play hockey, seen them leave, seen 2.0 come back. And with the way that the landscape is currently in the NHL, the Jets find themselves in maybe the most unenviable position of any franchise out there, where they are just legitimately behind the eight ball in terms of convincing a lot of players to spend the majority of their careers in Winnipeg. I'm also a big soccer fan, a Chelsea fan. Ugh, I know. Trust me, I know. But what fascinates me about specifically the Premier League is it seems to me like there's a greater realization and awareness from teams outside the big four, five, or six that they have to operate differently than other teams. It reminds me a little bit too like Moneyball in a sense, and how certain baseball teams operate differently than the Yankees and Dodgers do. They recognize their limitations and understand they have to act differently. And I think the Winnipeg Jets, more than any team in the NHL, and again, this is a macro thing. I don't think they can do this right now. But I think in terms of the future, I think they should position themselves as the premier team to give young talent a chance. You know how the old saying goes, tie goes to the vet in terms of roster spots? I think Winnipeg needs to zig when everyone else zags and say, no, tie goes to the youngster. And the reason I say this, too, is one, it would be a lot different than how any other team operates. But two, drafted players have a much more difficult time in terms of dictating where they're going to play. So if you could get those guys in, essentially force them into Winnipeg, that's your best shot at having high-end talent. And the one thing the Jets do accomplish at a pretty successful rate is when you come to Winnipeg, they do retain a lot of their talent, right? Scheifele, Hellebuck, Wheeler, Connor, Ehlers, Morrissey, going back to Buff, some of those other guys, right? You know what I mean? Like, they do a good job at being a legitimately high-end, well-run organization once you get your foot in the door. I think it's on Winnipeg to be a little more cognizant of how do we do that at a more consistent basis and how do we separate ourselves from the rest of the NHL. So, bit of a long-winded answer there, but appreciate the question on that one, Westy. Two more to go here. We'll try to wrap this one up quickly. Next up on the docket is Johnny. Johnny, it feels like an alias. Like, I don't know why. But Johnny asks, are you able to quantify the psychological impact of the players going from Arizona to Utah for this upcoming season? Short answer, no. I mean, look, if you've ever worked for a company that had a toxic work environment and everybody hated going to work every day, and then you got shipped off to a new business, new location, maybe the salary got increased a little bit, but you get a pizza day every single Friday, four-day work week, all that stuff. Think of your emotional satisfaction level skyrocketing to that point. That's what's going to happen with the Coyotes going out there to Utah right now. I think it's going to be a massive, massive boost. I am actually, and we always see one team go from near the bottom to finding their way into the big dance. Utah's going to be my team. I think Utah's going to be a playoff team this year. I think we're going to see a freshly rejuvenated bunch that went from an absolute clown show to a legitimate professional operation here. And I think just that, the shift in workplace dynamics alone, I think is going to be worth 6 to 8 points. And then the youth is going to take another step. Won't shock me to see Logan Cooley have himself a breakout campaign. I like what they're doing out there with the Yotes, or the Utah HC, I should say now. And yeah, I'm going to say that just going from clown show to this is how it should be done is going to get Utah into the playoffs this upcoming season. And I think it's going to be an absolute barn fire and a difficult out anytime somebody goes out there in Utah to try to take down the HC. So thanks for the question there, Johnny. Quickly on Utah, what should the team name be? As much as I love cryptozoology, the Utah Yeti makes absolutely no sense. The Yeti is a beast from Asia. Utah Bigfoot, maybe we have a different conversation, but that's not the case. The other ones, a little too iffy. Blizzard, I like the double Z matches up with the Jazz. A little too hokey for me. It's got to be Utah Mammoth. It's the only decision. It's got to be the Mammoth. The logo would be legit. Branding-wise, tons of different opportunities. The Mammoth, a regal, fearsome animal worthy of our respect. The Utah Mammoth. Get it done, Ryan Smith. Finally, our last question of the day here comes from Denver Dom. I wonder where he's going with this. And Denver Dom asks, ooh, I like this one. I love hypotheticals like this. Denver Dom asks, when it's all said and done, where is Cale Makar going to rank amongst the all-time great defensemen in NHL history? Awesome question. And it's pretty wild. Look, I get he's early in his career. I totally understand that. 25 years old, kind of crazy to be making statements like this. But you asked the question, so I'll answer it. And I think when it's all said and done, Cale Makar is going to put himself in position to stake claim for the second best defenseman in NHL history. I don't think anybody's ever going to touch Bobby Orr. He was such a transcendent player that my brain can't fathom anybody reaching the heights that he did in the 70s. But you watch Cale Makar out there right now, he's the damn near closest thing we've had since Bobby Orr hit the ice. And there's no flaws in his game either. I mean, offensively, it's evident. Even if you've never watched hockey before, he just moves different than everybody else out there on the ice. He's been arguably the most prolific point producer from the back end over the past three seasons. But even defensively, I can make the case defensively, he is as stout as anybody in the NHL. He's physical as all hell, too. Like, he's not that big of a dude. But you meet him, he's stirred. Like, he's going to knock the wind out of you. And it's not just a case of he's chasing points out there and leaving Devon Taves to clean up the mess behind him. Cale Makar, whether it's on the rush, in his own zone, defending the cycle, he's as good as it comes there as well. So if he gets full health and we get 10 more seasons of this level of play, I think he's right there with the Nick Lidstroms, the Ray Borks, and the Dennis Potvins, and maybe a few others. But I think we see Makar stamp himself amongst those greats. And if all goes according to plan, I think there's a legitimate case to be made that he ends up as the second best defenseman in NHL history. And the reason I say that too is there's very few times where you will say a defenseman is the best player in hockey. He's not quite that because McDavid's on a different level and MacKinnon is on almost a similar plane there too. But he's just behind. Like, he is not far behind them. It is what a joy. He is my favorite player in the league to watch, even over those other two mix, McDavid and MacKinnon. I think Cale Makar is every bit as good as the legends of the game on the back end there. How high he goes, it'll be intriguing to watch, but I think he's going to be in the mix. I think he's going to be right there. There's a differently than Lidstrom and Bork and Potvin, obviously. But if I had to make a guess right now, I think he gets up at number two. But we'll have to wait and see how that plays out. What we do know for certain, though, is that the episode comes to an end right now. Thank you guys so much for tuning in to another episode of the Hockey Mailbag. Really appreciate getting to hang out with you beauties once again. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, if you want to be a part of the podcast, just send your questions to thehockeymailbag@gmail.com or to me on Twitter @Brandon_Rewicki, and I'll get to those in a future episode. Also, don't forget to check out the rest of our four-part series breaking down each division in hockey ahead of the upcoming NHL season. In the meantime, I'm your host, Brandon Rewicki. Thanks again for tuning in, and I look forward to talking puck with you guys soon.